Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Tuesday, March 31st. In the COVID-19 era, we shouldn't just ask, what does mitigation look like? We should ask, what does mitigation with social justice look like? What does it look like for laid-off people who can't pay this month's rent? What does it look like for the people who deliver things, not just the people who order things? What does it mean for immigrants losing their jobs, as well as people born here, and much more? We're very happy to have with us now to talk about mitigation itself and mitigation with social justice, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who represents parts of Queens and the Bronx, who's been speaking and writing on these essential issues. Congresswoman, it's great of you to come on in the midst of all this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Of course. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And let's start on the news that some delivery workers went on strike or had sick outs yesterday. Some will do so today. Amazon, Instacart, Whole Foods in some places, and you've been tweeting about it. Could you say some of what's happening and why?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, in the case of Instacart and many of these other delivery services, workers are treated as independent contractors, as almost a cost-sharing measure by a lot of these major corporations, except when it comes to Amazon and Instacart and these large workers, they're experiencing record sales right now, but their workers are under unprecedented danger. Even in Woodside, a fulfillment facility, an Amazon fulfillment warehouse, has several cases of coronavirus in their workers working in the warehouse. Workers are scared. They don't feel like they have proper protective equipment, paid sick leave for everyone. You know, there's this idea that if you get tested, if you have coronavirus, you can get paid sick leave. But the problem with that is that it's so difficult to get a test. So there's a lot of folks that may have coronavirus that cannot get a test right now because those are being reserved for the most severe cases. And so these workers are starting to withhold their labor in order to demand some of the most basic, dignified work conditions that they deserve. And I think that, after years of being denied these very basic measures, they're taking matters into their own hands, and they're holding walkouts, they're holding sick outs. And, you know, this is power concedes nothing without a demand. And I think that it's the right course that they're taking.
Sick pay seems to me should be automatic. Hazard pay, the company should just give them hazard pay under these conditions. Mm-hmm. But how does society manage protection when there are severe shortages of protective equipment that you know about, but food and other essentials still have to get out to a country under a stay-at-home order?
Well, you know, a lot of what these Amazon workers are asking for, even beyond just protective equipment, is they want to know when someone in their facility has gotten sick with coronavirus. And we are hearing from workers that they do not believe that management is being honest with them, that there are and when they talk to each other, there are more workers that they believe are getting sick than what they are being told. When a worker is diagnosed with being sick, they force the workers to go into that facility without fully sanitizing it. There are conditions that go beyond just N95 masks in order to keep these workers safe. And as you mentioned, hazard pay is a very important element to all of this. And really just also, you know, basic health care is a larger conversation that we're going to have as a country. How do we provide real health care to people working hourly in vulnerable jobs?
What can consumers do to support the workers that they're depending on?
Well, there are quite a few kind of strike funds that are out there. There's one for the Amazon workers in particular called Amazonians United. If you want to kind of go above and beyond and support them financially, we're already sort of hearing stories about potential cases of retaliation. Yesterday, one of the workers that helped organized the walkout. I believe the one in Staten Island, but one of the worker walkouts in Amazon was notified of his termination. And, you know, of course, this looks retaliatory. And the reason that they cited for firing him was that he wasn't practicing social distancing. Not that he was organizing his workers and demanding more rights and all of these things, but that he wasn't 6 feet away from his from other workers around him, which is why he was allegedly fired. And so I think it's important that, you know, these strike funds can help workers take these risks, but also it could be as basic as don't cross a picket line. You know, if you can, if you're able to, try to order from a different service. There's lots of other ways that you can get the same thing accomplished. Or, you know, we also have to acknowledge that there's a lot of disabled and elderly folks who rely on these services. Maybe try offering to, take that trip to the grocery store for them. If you know someone that relies on these services, you know, just for the week. And it's really important that we stand in solidarity with these workers, because it's not enough just for us to thank our frontline workers. It's not enough for us to just thank our nurses and thank our delivery workers. The best way to thank them is to stand with them when they fight for better conditions in their lives. And these folks are essential workers, which means that they should be dignified and respected workers.
And I'll add that this should pertain to the domestic world, too. For people who hire babysitters or house cleaners, for example, you may not be Amazon, you may not be Instacart, but if you're no longer comfortable having those people come into your home, think about personal responsibility there and giving them months of pay and things like that. You know, Congresswoman, I've been thinking of the situation today in terms of a kind of racial justice paradox. Like black and brown people are more likely to lose their jobs in the crisis and suffer food and housing insecurity. The stats show that already. But they're also more likely to be the ones asked to keep their jobs and have risky contact with other people. So my question out of this is kind of broad. What does racial justice look like in a COVID-19 world?
Yes, and I'm glad that you bring this up, because there's absolutely, you know, racial and class inequities baked into this crisis. If you are able to stay home, you are a privileged person in this moment and you know, in this crisis. A lot of people cannot afford to stay home for a lot of different reasons. And that's on the economic side of things. On the public health side of things, there are additional layers as well that affect racial justice and black and brown folks in particular. You know, we have the crisis in Rikers that's going on right now. And every single person in there, from the physicians to even correctional officers, are basically indicating that it's a ticking time bomb. And you have that element of it. Additionally, you have a long-standing phenomenon of black and brown patients in hospitals, in particular black women, whose pain indices are not taken as seriously or treated as seriously as what their self-reporting indicates. So very often, it's widely reported in medical literature that, say, you have a patient who is a black woman come in and say that they're feeling you know, pain on a level of an 8 scale, and it gets treated as though she's feeling pain on a 6 or 7 scale. And we've already seen coronavirus cases of people who have passed away, and black and brown people who have passed away, who ask for tests repeated times, say that their symptoms are really bad, and they get denied tests despite exhibiting symptoms. So we have all of these existing inequities, and this crisis, like it's done in so many other realms, has hit fast forward in essentially exacerbating these issues. So I think there's a couple of things we can do in terms of racial justice in the coronavirus. One is that we need to start pursuing decarceral policies on Rikers Island, and we needed to start doing it weeks ago. We need to examine elderly clemency. There are people in Rikers Island that physicians have reported they have treated 80-year-olds, 90-year-olds, infirm people that are still kept in a cage. We need to explore elderly clemency. We need to explore the rapid release. You know, there's some level to which this is going on, but it needs to be done on a much larger level. The physician on Rikers yesterday was basically saying, was appalled at the lack of really humanitarian measures and humanitarian releases that are happening on Rikers right now and the pushback to that. But additionally, there's also the economic piece. As you mentioned, these essential workers are overwhelmingly lower income. They're Black, they're brown. And these are the folks that are stocking our grocery shelves. They're the ones that are delivering our food. And they still have to pay rent tomorrow. And there's no way, there is no way that hundreds of thousands of people in New York City are going to be able to pay their rent and pay their mortgage when through no fault of their own, you know, half of the city's economy has been suspended. And we have to make sure that we are addressing their needs. I know that the city council speaker, Corey Johnson, has called for a rent moratorium. Senator Janaris in my district of Queens has introduced that legislation on a state level, and that's been supported by Alessandro Biaggi and Jessica Ramos, Catalina Cruz, Julia Salazar. These are the measures that we need to make sure that we're taking so that we have working people back in this crisis.
And I want to come back in a few minutes to the question of rent in New York State in particular. But let me take a phone call for you right now. Nancy on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Hello, Nancy.
Yes. Good morning, Mrs. Cortez, Brian. And I also would like to thank all the people, doctors, nurses, everybody that is just right there on the front line. Mm-hmm. My first comment is about the welfare centers. I work in one of those centers, and the people that come to apply, they don't have masks, they don't have gloves, and we not even have gloves to attend these people that come in need. And most of the people are homeless, people who are in shelters, people who are sick, and the social workers, we don't have protection against any of this, not even the security officers. They have to deal with all this, and people get frustrated.
There's in every case possible, we need to make sure that we're transitioning welfare and social safety net services to phone and online. I know that in our district, the social security offices have been transitioning to phone calls, but we need to make sure that we're following those similar protocols across the board from SNAP, WIC, Medicaid, and so on.
For people here in New York, you've been calling for a rent freeze for people who can't make their payments, and that's obviously very immediate, as the first of the month is tomorrow. And you've been unsatisfied with how far Governor Cuomo has gone. But let me play you a clip from his briefing yesterday in which he said the issue has been addressed.
Again, I think our policy answers it. You cannot be evicted for non-payment of rent. It's not that you won't owe rent at one time, right? Because you signed the contract, even the people to whom you pay the rent have to pay the rent, right? And they have expenses. So no evictions for non-payment of rent, and then we'll see where we are, and we'll see how long this goes on.
Governor Cuomo yesterday. So why doesn't no evictions for 90 days rise to the standard that you're aiming for?
Well, you know, I've talked to the governor about this because, you know, I think in other policies and decisions that he's made, he's almost indicated that it's not enough. When you apply his own standard to his decisions and his calls on mortgages, the governor has not just issued a foreclosure moratorium in the state of New York. He has called for mortgage payment suspensions. And so if he believes that just placing a moratorium on foreclosures isn't enough, surely a person who's made that decision should also apply that standard to renters and say that a foreclosure on just evictions isn't enough. If you called for a payment on if you called for a suspension or a moratorium on mortgage payments, then we should also call for that same treatment on rent payments. And when you hold one standard, we're being more generous to mortgagers than, or rather people who are receiving mortgages, than you are on people who are renters, which is two-thirds of New York City. We're kind of creating a class and race issue. We're essentially rewarding and offering preferential treatment to landowners and folks who are more wealthy, and we're not offering that same kind of relief to renters. And so, you know, I think it's a really important issue that we also provide rent moratoriums from an equity issue, but also even just from an economic perspective. I think it's not responsible to just ignore this problem and ignore the fact that hundreds of thousands, and frankly, nationally, millions of people are no longer going to be able to pay their rent. And the fact that we're just waiting for April 1st to come around just to see what happens, we know what's going to happen. Hundreds of thousands of people aren't going to pay their rent, which means lots of people are not going to be able to pay their mortgages, which means we're going to have a crush on capital in the banks if we don't do something about this.
You want to hear some pushback from a landlord? Here's sure. Marianne in Edison. You're on WNYC with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Congresswoman from Queens in the Bronx. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. Good morning, Brian and Congresswoman. My question has to do with, I'm a landlord. I own two apartment buildings, a total of 32 apartments. And come May 1st, I'm going to have to pay $21,000 in property tax. And if there's a moratorium on rent, then how do the landlords manage to pay that, plus supply all the utilities that are needed, the heat, hot water, gas, electric, garbage collection, all of that? What's happening on the landlord's end?
Yes, no, thank you. That's an excellent question, because ultimately what we're aiming to do is to make sure that no person is feeling the squeeze from this. There are discussions currently going on about what we do with property taxes in the state, whether we move that deadline, whether we move that down, whether there's partial forgiveness or so on. So this is an ongoing conversation that's acknowledged that if we want to pursue a rent moratorium, there are these things that we need to pursue. When it comes to utilities, you know, I think that that's also a conversation that we can have, whether we can break off utility costs, if utility costs are currently in your rent, if that can be broken off as a smaller expense that people can cover. But right now, there is also a utility shut-off moratorium in the state as well. I think ultimately, what this crisis does is that it has shown us quite a lot of need. And we need to make the decision one way or the other if we are going to rise to that need or not. And I think what's very important, which is why one of the reasons why I'm not saying that we should have a rent moratorium and not a mortgage moratorium, is because we need to make sure that if we're going to provide this relief, we address all of the other issues, whether it's property taxes or utilities, that can help make that relief happen. So I do believe that the question of property taxes is being raised by the state. Do we still have this May 1st deadline? Do we extend it? I think the questions on utilities is a good one. And I think it's a question of if it's already in your rent, do we separate that out, provide a suspension on rent and continue to allow people to pay their utilities, or do we find some other way with a state authority? Uh-huh.
Marianne, thank you so much for your call. Congresswoman, let me play you a clip of the president and ask you how much of a meaningful pivot to being serious about the pandemic you think the president has now made. Here he is yesterday at his briefing with a few of the kinds of things that he's been emphasizing that he's doing.
FEMA and HHS already delivered 11.6 million N95 respirators, 26 million surgical masks, 5.3 million face shields, 4.4 million surgical gowns, and 22 million gloves.
And the list went on to many other things. So we know he began this process in complete willful ignorance. My question is, how much of a meaningful pivot to being serious about the pandemic do you think the president has now made?
Well, I think right now the president is, he's playing catch up. And I think that the seriousness, you know, if he's making a pivot, if he's taking it seriously, I think it's just a matter of reality kind of defying the decisions that he's trying to make. He said, let's open everything up by Easter. And obviously that's not happening. He's now pushed it back to April 30th. But it was kind of a ridiculous assessment that was not rooted in science or public health for him to kind of lick his finger and put it up in the air and feel the wind and say Easter. And so I don't think that he is being proactive. And, you know, there are certain elements where I guess you could say he's taking it seriously, but I think that we can't, you know, I've been frustrated by folks who are just assessing his tone more than his actions and saying, oh, well, you know, he sounds serious. If the president is serious, he would enact the Defense Production Act to create ventilators to meet the nation's needs.
He says he did that. By the way, he said he did that over the weekend. He ordered Ford to do that. I mean, GM to do that when they wouldn't do it on his own. Is there more with the Defense Production Act that he could do?
I think there's absolutely more that could be done. And, you know, I think what is tricky with his statements right now is that you know, even yesterday, I was on a call with the congressional delegation, and they are unsure if he's actually invoking the Defense Production Act or not. You know, he's doing this dance where one day he says that he's invoking it, the next day he's not. And so it's created a quite a lot of confusion as to whether he's actually doing it or not. And so, but the thing is that we need tens of thousands of ventilators for New York City alone. And ideally, the way that we would have been able to do this is produce these tens of thousands of ventilators, contain the crisis, and so that when it hits another city, we can ship those ventilators, as Governor Cuomo offered to do, ship those ventilators to another city. But the problem is because this outbreak has not been taken seriously in every part of the country, we may not be able to stop this outbreak from happening in other cities. We're seeing it in New Orleans. We're seeing it across Florida. We may not be able to contain it before the time that New York City's crisis has wound down. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to need even more ventilators instead of shipping them from one city to another because our containment policies aren't working.
And I saw you retweeted a Rachel Maddow tweet from yesterday that repeated one line three times, and the line was, nationalize the supply chain of critical medical supplies, something we've been talking about here, too, so states and cities don't have to compete with each other, bidding up the price, which is crazy to have to do in this national emergency. And it's, of course, so relevant to your district with Elmhurst Hospital and the rest of Queens, the hardest hit county in America in many ways. My question about this is nationalizing the supply chain something you all in Congress could do something about if the president won't?
Oh, you know, I think that's an excellent question. I guess the problem is that if the president won't, and if the president refuses to do that, then he will not sign a bill from Congress saying and trying to do that. So ultimately, he's the kind of bottleneck on this issue. And we have, you know, it's absolutely ridiculous, and it just points to the lunacy of our for-profit healthcare system in the United States, that we are here with a public health crisis and governors are in a bidding war to offer the most amount of profit to some of these suppliers in order to treat people in need. It's a waste of resources. It's a waste of public funds. And we just need to get these things produced and out there. And the idea that we're still in this for-profit bidding war in the middle of a public health crisis that is going to result in more deaths. You know, this health crisis it's people aren't just dying of coronavirus. They're dying of incompetence. They're dying due to for-profit motives. They're dying due to, you know, lack of management and lack of listening to scientists. Those are exacerbating the numbers of these deaths, and those are exacerbating cases. And it's, you know, so this isn't just a viral pandemic. It's a pandemic of a lack of leadership. And sure. That's a very real thing that we need to be naming and acknowledging right now.
And I know I'm holding you over time, but I also know you want to say something about the census, with Census Day being tomorrow. What's your message?
Yes, so tomorrow's Census Day, I cannot ask everyone enough, if you haven't already, please fill out your census form. It should be in your mailbox. If for any reason it's not in your mailbox, you can just call up the Census Bureau, just Google the phone number, call up the census, tell them who you are. It's so important that we all get counted, because that is how funding gets allocated to our communities. So if you feel like your schools are underfunded, if you feel like your hospitals are underfunded, it may be because the government does not know you exist if you didn't fill out your census form the last time around. This is how we get congressional representation. This is how we get votes on the floor of Congress. This is how we get money to our schools. This is how we get books and teachers and doctors and nurses. So please make sure that you fill out your census and ask your neighbors, help your family and everyone you know fill out the census, because this is a major shot for New York City to get way more resources than we have in the last 10 years.
Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, thank you so much for your time today. Stay safe.
Of course, you too.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a Daily Coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller, or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.